Hello and welcome to another edition of Critical Q&A, the show where I answer your questions based on what you've left for me in the comments section below on my Q&A videos or have sent to me by email at askchrisshelton@gmail.com. As usual, I welcome all questions of whatever kind. This week we've got some pretty interesting ones, and we're going to get right to it because I think we're going to have a lot of ground to cover here. So here we go. Cassie W., why in the world does the Church of Scientology interact with the Nation of Islam, NOI? Their philosophies and purposes are so divergent. All indications from agencies and groups, such as the Southern Poverty Law Center, etc., are that the NOI, the American Black Muslims Group, are a racial solidarity group, anti-white, anti-Jewish, misogynistic, and their core beliefs hold that white people and NOI members should not intermingle, let alone intermarry, etc. In short, they are a racial hate group, and so classified as such by most agencies. So why is there now an alliance between the Church of Scientology and the NOI? It's unfathomable to me. I know that the NOI has a creation philosophy as strange as Scientology's Xenu story. The NOI holds that an evil scientist named Jacob bred all the good out of people, along with the pigment of their skin, so that white people are inherently evil. This story is so unbelievable as to make the Xenu story seem reasonable in comparison. It seems so strange that Scientology / NOI have any interaction. Can you shed any light on this? Well, I'm going to tell you my experience with it. I don't have a whole historical, thing on this because it was just as much a surprise to me and almost every other Scientologist when the NOI collaboration sort of was sprung on us. I think around 2011, 2010-ish, something like that, I was in Minnesota on project in the Twin Cities Church of Scientology when it came up and it was announced that the local NOI chapters were going to be coming into the Churches of Scientology strictly to do Dianetics training. And then they were going to go and audit each other on using the Dianetics techniques. There was not to be any Scientology given to them. It was only to be Dianetics right out of the book, Dianetics, the Modern Science of Mental Health, and the introductory, type services that are given for Dianetics training, which is like this Dianetics auditor's course. And they were all going to come in and do it. They were going to get a discounted rate on it. And we were actually given packets of information about how to deal with NOI members. Like there were whole rules and guidelines to it. And I actually got this and briefed the staff of the Twin Cities org at the time on, these guys are going to come, and it was going to be a specific date that they were all supposed to show up, and they were only to do these services, and they were going to pay X amount of money, and they were going to come in, and da-da-da, and then they were going to leave. And so the do's and don'ts was pretty interesting, like, for example, no swearing. There was not to be any swearing around them. Manners were supposed to be kept, very, very tight and very in with the NOI members. And personally, I don't have a lot of background. I didn't go anywhere and start looking up data on the Nation of Islam then or now before I answered this question. So I can't really speak to the, Farrakhan or the leaders of the NOI and what their personal beliefs are or what they preach to their, their people. I really don't know exactly. I've seen quotes, and I've seen some things, of course, that were pretty, pretty racial, against white people. But I have to say that my interaction with the NOI members was really nothing but some of the most mannered, good, reasonable conversations ever. I mean, these were very, very nice people, well-dressed, carried themselves well, paid a lot of attention to that sort of thing. And maybe they were just being really, really super polite to all of us white people, because, of course, in Twin Cities at the Church of Scientology, there's nothing but white people. There were maybe one or two black staff members who came on board once the thing really started going, you know, and they got their ideal org, and the staff numbers picked up. There were a couple of Black people who joined staff or came in from other areas, literally other geographical locations like St. Louis and that sort of thing. But by far the predominant, you know, race of the staff in Twin Cities was Caucasian. And so we were all on our best behavior. And they seemed to be too, right? And they came in and they were pretty easy to deal with and pretty easy to train. And then they went off on their way. And there really weren't that many of them. You know, there was this idea there were going to be so many, hundreds and hundreds, you know. And it was about 20 or so, you know, 25. I think the total list was maybe 25 or 30 names, but not all of them showed up. And they did the one Dianetics course, and then they left. And I think after that, what I started hearing about and what happened in Twin Cities is one or two of them got personally curious about Scientology and about L. Ron Hubbard and what else did he have to say and what else did he put out and that sort of thing. And so then they started doing more, those particular people started doing Scientology services, right? Even though it had to be 100% on their own origination. We could not engage in any salesmanship or any sort of regging or, you know, the words that we use in Scientology, right? There couldn't be any of that, right? No. Like this was, they were hands off for that sort of thing. Which was completely counter to how all other people are treated when they come into a Church of Scientology. So it was very different, very strange. And none of us really understood the backstory to how was it that the NOI got hooked up with the Church of Scientology in the first place. There was conjecture, of course, you know, that David Miscavige had gotten excited about these people and their interest in Hubbard or their interest in Dianetics. Because Farrakhan, I heard him speak highly of Dianetics and how L. Ron Hubbard was somebody who had come up with something that they could use to achieve their goals. And I thought to myself that perhaps Miscavige was excited about that because at the time Harlem and Inglewood and there were overt remarks made at events and whatnot by David Miscavige to entice or talk to or get the Black community of America more involved in Scientology. And I don't know where that came from, but that was something he was saying, right? And so the NOI were some kind of maybe, you know, springboard into that. Although, you know, when you find out about the NOI, you find out that they're a very minority group amongst Black people. I mean, they're separate, you know, they're not representative of Black culture overall, you know. So it wasn't like this was going to appeal, you know, because we got the NOI and we were going to get all these other Black people in. That's not how that was going to work. So I didn't really know. I found out later that Farrakhan had gotten involved in Dianetics and Scientology years before, and it had all been very hush-hush and very quiet and whatnot, and he was very favorable about it. Why, I don't know, but he was. At least that's what I heard. This is all rumor line. And so so they'd worked on him and worked on him and then, you know, gotten this whole influx of people. And maybe Miscavige or, you know, whoever had the idea, well, it would have to be Miscavige, would have had the idea that this was somehow going to open the flood doors, you know, to millions of NOI members coming on board. But of course, shortly after this happened, what I also saw on YouTube was, you know, the NOI splintering on this and there being NOI members who were like absolutely not okay with these orders that they were receiving to go, you know, into Churches of Scientology and start doing and learning things from L. Ron Hubbard, right? So I saw protests about that. So I know this was a major cause of friction and factioning within the NOI. And so, you know, it came, it went. Now, I think there are maybe a small sampling of the NOI who are still involved actively with Church Scientology, but it's not like the whole NOI have come in and are now all Scientologists. If you think that, you have a very wrong idea of the picture. It's not like that. There's maybe this alliance at the top, but it has not filtered all the way down to the bottom where all the NOI are now on board as Scientologists and can't wait to achieve the state of clear. There are certain select NOI executives or high-level NOI members who are part of Scientology and speak at its events and things like that. But it's not like these two groups have meshed somehow. That's not the picture. So that's kind of what I can talk about it. I know it's not a lot. It's my limited amount of experience with it, but I was there the day they came in and started doing services, and then they all left, and that's what happened, you know. And so that's what I can speak firsthand about, and I hope that that answers at least some of your questions about it. And otherwise, you know, for more, you'd have to do your own research on this, but that's what I can tell you. Dan B. In the Sea Org, is there any privacy in the bunk bed filled rooms? If there's no privacy in those crammed rooms and nobody is allowed to masturbate, what is everybody doing in the shower? I'm very frustrated that ex-Scientologists rarely complain about privacy and having 50 people share one toilet. Okay, well, you know, I've never particularly made loud noises about this, but no one in the Sea organization is happy about the crammed quarters and the lack of privacy, and it is an issue. Because there's never enough birthing space. That's what we called it. We didn't call them our rooms. It's our birthing, right? And of course, if you're married in the Sea organization, you get a room. You don't get an apartment or something like that. You get a room, and that's your bedroom, and that's where you know sleep and do your marital activities. And if you're not married, you live in dorms. And those dorms can get pretty crowded. I saw rooms with upwards of 50 people, depending on the size of the room and the way the arrangement of the bunk beds. The bunks would usually go 2, 3, and I had even seen 4 high. And, you know, when I was on the Rehabilitation Project Force, the RPF, of course, they went 4 high. We were really crammed in like sardines in our rooms. And of course, when you're on the RPF, there is no marriage space. You're all in dorms, right? It's the women and it's the men. But as far as regular Sea Org life goes, yeah, there's very, very little privacy. Bathrooms are used to hide out, take naps, and yeah, you know, yes, people did go and get caught in the bathrooms masturbating. That did occur, and so, you know, or in the showers, you know, guys would. I go in the shower in the morning and there's some guy, you know, and that shower is just going, and you're like, what the hell is that guy doing in there, you know? Yeah, so there was that. And it's not like anybody ever went back and, you know, threw the curtain back or something. But, you know, it was a really sucky existence. I mean, sometimes there weren't even shower curtains, though. And of course, you know, then you'd have to take a shower and it's like right in front of God and everybody, right? It was, you know, and you'd get up in the morning, and if you didn't get in early or later than everybody else, then you couldn't be up standing in line waiting to get in the shower. And, you know, and all the little pet peeves and everything, guys walking down the hall brushing their teeth, that just grossed me out. I just, ugh. You know, sometimes there was one floor on the third floor, they had, second or third floor of the main building, that big blue building that says Scientology on it, that's the birthing building in Los Angeles that I lived in. There were some other places people could live too, but that's where I was. And on the second floor of that building, there were some individual showers. There was a hallway that had 2 individual showers, and couples would go in there sometimes. That was kind of funny. Shower in the morning together sort of thing, right? Anyway, so no, not a lot of privacy. Right? Really not. And even, you know, even Sunday mornings were the time where it was called CSP time, or clean ship program. And this is basically where you're supposed to clean the ship. You're supposed to clean, like, you know, your quarters where you live. And so Sunday mornings, we'd all go down and muster up. The whole base would muster up at like 9 a.m. and everybody would be accounted for. And then you'd have to go back to your floor where you live, and all the floors would muster up. And then they'd go and do the common areas first, the hallways and the bathrooms. And then you'd go clean your individual room, and security guards would come around, and you couldn't leave and go get go to the store and buy whatever you needed to buy, like soap or, you know, socks or whatever you needed to get for the week, until a security guard had come and given you a signed slip that he had checked your room out, right? It was this draconian. This is life in the Sea Org, right? And it's, I mean, you know, it's just, it's really sucky. There's just really no life in Sea Org life. You're just a machine. You're a cog in a wheel of, you know, monotony, and that's kind of your existence. And the days off come few and far between, you know, for most Sea Org members. It's at best, you can get a day off once every 2 weeks. At best case scenario. So, you know, every other Sunday would be your liberties. That's what they call it. They don't call it a day off. They call it liberties or libs. You know, and it was so painful to get days off that, you know, most of the time I didn't even bother trying. So that's kind of that existence, you know, and of course, when you got your days off, you could spend it in your room listening to music or whatever, but you could expect to be hassled by security guards who also roam around in the birthing spaces during the day to make sure no one is going to their rooms during the day when they're supposed to be on their post working, right? And this was just a routine thing. You know, when I was leaving the Sea Org, I was kind of, you know, in my quarters a lot during the day, or I'd be out cleaning the bathrooms or doing whatever I was doing. But a lot of time was spent in the room that I was in. And the security guys were coming around every day, you know, and what are you doing in here? What's going on? What's happening? You know, sort of thing. Why are you in here? And it just gets tiring after a while. So you just don't even want to be, you know, in your room at all when that kind of thing is going on. And that's the whole point of that, is they're trying to catch you out, you know, trying to find people who are slacking off. You know, this whole Sea Org life is all about not slacking. So you get very creative on places to be and things to do so that you can get little moments of time to yourself. And unfortunately, most of those places where you can hide out are restrooms, because nobody's going to hassle you in the restroom. You know, they'll knock on the door, but they won't, they won't open the door on you when you're in there. So that was about the only privacy that you could be guaranteed of getting. So yeah, it was that bad. It does suck that hard, and they put up with it because they think they're so mistaken. But they really think that they put up with that lack of freedom because they're doing something to change the world. And it's so pathetic. You know, looking back on it now, it's sad. So, Ada, please tell us more about the Thetan. I understand that early on, Scientologists are taught that each one of us is a Thetan with billions of years of life, going from one body to another, having a memory, engrams, of everything traumatic that happened. Did I get it right? Since Scientologists know nothing about what's in the OT levels for a long time, they believe that they are dealing with this one Thetan in their body. What is the goal of all the courses they take before the OT levels? To unburden the Thetan from engrams and make him operate the body in a more capable way? It is not to expel him, right? What happens when the body dies? How does the Thetan move to another body and when? Any grace period? Since all adults have a Thetan in them, or do they, does that mean that a Thetan has to move to a newborn? Is there a fight between Thetans over a baby's body? And if I had achieved the state of clear, is my Thetan going to a new body in a state of clear, thus that next person is spared all of the problems of a pre-clear? Is this the way to clear the planet? If I'm a Thetan, it should not be a big deal for me if the body I occupy ceases to exist. I will move to another body, maybe a better one. So why the emphasis on making this body less sick or with better vision? Can a Thetan simply leave the body on his own volition, or does the body have to die for him to leave? Does he have a sex, or can he move from male to female bodies? When I listen to people recalling past lives, they are always the same sex. Anyhow, you get the gist, trying to get the skinny on Thetans according to the cult. Did they think it through? And my question does not cover OT levels, body Thetans. Okay, wow, big question here, lots of stuff. And so let me give you just a broad general overview, although a lot of your question kind of answers itself, because a lot of the information that you're asking me about is kind of, yeah, that's exactly how it is. You nailed it. Except the only thing I have an objection to in the wording of the question is you keep referring to your Thetan. And it's not your Thetan, it's you. The Thetan is the spiritual being who is you. That's the whole point of it in Scientology, is you don't have a soul, you don't have a spirit, you don't have a Thetan, like it's something you own. It is you. So, you know, every thought you have, every idea, every creative impulse, every response, everything, all of that is you. So that's you know, a Thetan, but it's you. Okay. So that being said, yes, there is one main spiritual entity occupying your body, and that is you. When your body dies, you move off somehow. Sometimes after a long period of time, sometimes not. It kind of depends on you and your ability and perception and awareness as to, you know, what you're going to do, right? But there are these pre-installed thought processes and patterns called implants, which force Thetans to go get another body, right? Go to a hospital, find a newborn or somebody who is shortly to be born, maybe in a pregnant woman, and assume control of that body. And then you're in that body now, and you live out that life, right? And sex doesn't matter. Male, female, doesn't matter. And as far as, I don't know what exposure you have to stories of auditing, but generally Scientologists freely recall past lives of males and females, and Thetans don't have sex or asex. They're just spiritual entities, right? Because according to Scientology theory, all of this is according to Scientology theory. I'm not saying I believe any of this stuff. Thetans have been around for a near infinite amount of time into the past and will be a near infinite amount of time into the future. They don't die. They can, what happens to them is they can go into degraded states of existence where they might as well be dead, or they feel dead, or they've you know, decreased their awareness down to that of a rock or something, but they're still alive in that state of existence. And that's where, you know, you find body Thetans and whatnot, is in a very sleep, unconscious sort of state. But, you know, if you're not in that state, then you're like, you know, you or me, we're aware, we talk, we walk, we have a life. Then you go from life to life to life. And it could be that, you know, back in the way, way, way distant past, other body types existed besides just, you know, Homo sapiens here on planet Earth. You go back planets and, you know, galaxies distant and other places, and you're occupying other kinds of bodies that may or may not have the same kind of male-female sort of relationships and stuff like that. You know, it's all imagination, really, I think, but that's what it kind of comes down to. So, as far as can he leave the body on his own volition, well, that's part of the goal of Scientology, is to raise a person's spiritual awareness to where they, when they talk about being cause over life in Scientology as one of the abilities that you get at its highest levels, that means a full ability to do or be wherever you want to be, whenever you want to be, right? Which sounds kind of cool, right? It's kind of superpower-ish, right? You know, you can like, and you're on the sun, you know, or snap and you're on the other side of the galaxy, right? This sort of thing, or in the other room, that kind of thing. You know, you can just kind of be anywhere you want to be, because according to the basic definition of what a Thetan actually is, it's not a physical universe thing or quantity or substance. It's not, you know, a Thetan doesn't have ectoplasm and stuff like that. It's not a Ghostbusters, you know. A Thetan is a non-physical entity that doesn't have mass, motion, you know, weight, wavelength, anything like that. It exists outside of space and time. And the only reason that Thetans are aware of what's going on in the physical universe and assume control of a body and look through its eyes and that sort of thing is because that's what they want to do and that's what they consider they are doing. Because all of this is created by Thetans, right? Who agree that this is the world as they want it to be, and so here it is. And because the, you know, the sort of the physical universe that we all live in Scientology is sort of the sum total of everybody's agreement of how things are. And it has been agreed upon this way for millions and millions and millions of years, as old as the physical universe is. But thetans are older than the physical universe, you see. So anyway, this is where things get pretty vague. Hubbard was not crystal clear on exactly how old the physical universe is, exactly how old thetans are, where they came from exactly. Doesn't get into it. Never, not anywhere in Scientology materials have I found an exact, precise, this is where we are from. Right? That's not given in Scientology. There's a lot of unanswered questions in Scientology about life and the nature of life. You know, like plant life and animal life. Are those, you know, thetans? Are there thetans in every ant that animates, you know, that life? Or is there a thetan collectively over ant hives or something, you know? Like it's not clear. Hubbard was never really clear about that sort of thing. So there's unanswered questions on this subject. So no, it's not a complete topic that was all the way thought through. But Hubbard did spend a lot of time talking about trying to get people out of their heads or exterior, going exterior, he called it, because that was supposed to prove to a person that they were a spiritual being, they were timeless, they were, you know, of infinite life and that sort of thing. And it was, and there was a lot of work put in on that in the 1950s and whatnot. And the ultimate goal of Scientology's training and auditing is to achieve these high states of awareness where you can just be you as a spiritual entity and you don't have to have a body, or you could, and it's all up to you. And your life is pretty much the way you want it to be, and you want to make it. So, that's about it. JC, I really love your videos and this little community you're part of. I grew up in Los Angeles and my parents were keen on telling me to never get involved with Scientology and signs that you might be interacting with a front group. All three of us have seen Going Clear multiple times. Do you still feel a certain type of way about psychiatry? Sometimes I wonder if this bias is the major unifying factor among Scientologists, even if they one day leave the church. Thank you. I wouldn't say that an antagonism or antipathy towards psychiatry is the major unifying subject between all Scientologists, even those who leave. I'd say more of the spiritual beliefs that I was just laying out are probably more of the more unifying belief that keeps most Scientologists together. As far as psychiatry goes, no, I have radically changed my views on the subject since I left Scientology, because I've done research on it and I've educated myself on it versus just falling for and believing all the claptrap that Hubbard had to say about it. It wasn't all claptrap, of course. Hubbard's view of psychiatry was right out of the 1940s and 50s. And psychiatry back then was very different from how it is now. And I'm not saying it's, you know, leaps and bounds better, but in a number of ways it is, right? Ice pick lobotomies and things like that, they happened. I mean, that's not, Hubbard didn't make that stuff up. It wasn't straight out of his imagination that, you know, psychiatrists operated on people with transorbital leucotomies and lobotomies and things like that, or that they electric shocked people in an abusive fashion. Or that there are, you know, there's too much of a proliferation of psychotropic medications out there, especially with kids. You know, these are controversial issues that way more people than Scientologists are talking about. There are whole groups out there who are very, very anti-psychiatry when it comes to those practices. But those people aren't calling for abolishing all of psychiatry because some psychiatrists electric shock people. You know, they want to get rid of that practice, but they don't want to get rid of psychiatry or psychology, because those are the only fields that anybody's really looking into. How do we think, you know, and what's going on with the way we look at the world and that sort of thing, right? And there's been a lot of good stuff that's come out of some of those studies. All the stuff we talk about with, for example, mind control techniques, cognitive dissonance, confirmation bias, a lot of the the things that you learn about in critical thinking have psychological or, have their bases in psychological studies, right? And they sort of feed one another. And psychiatry has done a lot of good for a lot of people. There are some people that psychotropic medications are exactly what they need to live a higher quality of life. And I'm not down on that at all. I have nothing to say about that. You know, if psychotropics are doing you good, great. And if they're not, and the side effects are not good for you, and that's what's happening, then get off of them or get with your doctor and figure out a different alternative way of dealing with the issues that you're having, right? Because if they're not for everybody, some people have very negative reactions to those things. It is very far from a hard science. In other words, like a very locked down, very figured out sort of subject, right? Psychology and psychiatry do not have it figured out, at all. But I support a lot of the work that they're doing in order to try to figure it out. And they certainly have it better figured out than Scientology. So that's kind of my view on it at this point. Time for flash answers. Jessica Stewart. Question: did you know or hear of anyone in the Sea Org who were there for nefarious or disingenuous reasons, but were able to pass the rigorous E-meter testing? How long could someone fake their interest before they were rooted out by the organization? I've only seen like one or two people who actually tried to infiltrate Scientology that I know of, like personally. I know and heard that there were people earlier, which was the basis of a lot of the development of a lot more use of that rigorous, those rigorous E-meter checks, where they check you out to see if you're from the CIA, the FBI, the NSA, or some other, alphabet organization from the government or something, or from the media there to investigate Scientology. They check all that stuff out with people who come in. But here's the thing, the meter doesn't work the way they think it does, and it's not hard at all to fool it, right? Or to get past a meter check if you know how to, pay attention. Or talk your way through it when, something reacts on the meter and they got to clear it up with you. You can say just about anything you want and it gets it and get it cleared up. So it's not hard to beat the meter, so to speak. There are many, many instances of that happening that I observed, and of course that I engaged in myself at certain times, like when I was on the Rehabilitation Project Force, and it was just, I'd say anything to get the fuck out of there. Pardon my French. So, yeah. Thomas Schmitz. In your own personal opinion, what would you make of the mindset and rationality and, well, to put it frankly, sanity of anyone who has reached the high levels of OT 7 and 8? I know you're not a doctor, nor do you play one on TV, but in all seriousness, would a Scientologist who reaches those levels be deemed, in your opinion, mentally, if not also morally, really screwed up and clinically, insert your adjective here, by a medical professional, aka psychiatrist, psychologist? Well, I'm not about to sit here and pronounce any kind of psychiatric or psychology judgment on anyone who, especially, people at the upper levels of Scientology, because a broad general label that I put on all Scientologists who reach the highest levels of OT would be totally wrong according to everything I know as a critical thinker. I don't think that people who reach those levels are inherently insane or something like that. They have a more accurate way of describing what happens to somebody who reaches those levels is they have bought into a series of agreements about how they and the world work. And while a lot of those agreements don't make a whole hell of a lot of sense, a lot of things we all agree to don't make a whole lot of sense, but we agree to them anyway because they make our life easier or better, or they get us somewhere where we think we want to go. And that's what happens with upper-level Scientologists. They pays their money, and they have to agree that L. Ron Hubbard is saying the truth, and they have to agree with those truths, and they do so in order to achieve what they think is a worthwhile goal of ultimate spiritual freedom and personal immortality. And that's a you know, it'd be a pretty awesome thing if you could achieve that. And that's what they're trying to do. Through the process of auditing and studying Hubbard's works, you are given a lot of false information. You're given a lot of what I consider to be emotionally damaging practices, and your thought processes, you're indoctrinated into thinking like Hubbard. You're indoctrinated into thinking like he wants you to think. And so you know, that's kind of grooved into how you look at the world. That's true for any destructive cult. That's what destructive cults are all about. And that's why we call them destructive cults. So I'm not going to be somebody who's going to put a label on those people and call them certifiable or insane or nuts or any of that kind of stuff. I will say that some of their behavior could be viewed a little in, you know, like, that's interesting. But I think that the damage can be, that whatever damage is done to a person at that level can be undone through education and through, you know, sort of de-indoctrination, if that's a term, right? Sort of like getting the indoctrination flushed out of the person, just like I've had to go through for the last couple of years. And I think that's the most accurate way I can describe upper-level Scientologists. All right, so thank you very much for watching me for another week of questions and answers about Scientology. I've really enjoyed answering some of these, and I hope you've enjoyed my answers. Feel free to leave any comments, any feedback, any questions for me in the comments section below. I do see all of them, and I collect them up and put them in my queue and get around to answering them. And I hope that, you know, we're going to keep talking about the fact that on June 4th, I'm going to be in Washington, D.C. with my podcast partner, Ruth, for the Reason Rally. And I hope you guys will be able to attend that too, because I think it's going to be a lot of fun and a real advancing of critical thinking and skepticism. So until next week, see you guys later.